Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Libyan forces battle militiamen in Benghazi, and Malawi inaugurates a newly elected president. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Libyan military forces loyal to former Army Chief of Staff General Khalifa Haftar are battling militiamen from the al-Qaeda-affiliated Ansar al-Sharia group in Benghazi, with planes and helicopters bombing Ansar al-Sharia positions. Edward Uranium reports for VOA from Cairo that Libyan TV says 20 people are dead and more than 80 wounded.
Libyan army helicopters strafed positions of the al-Qaeda-linked Ansar al-Sharia militia in the eastern port city of Benghazi Monday amid sporadic fighting. Libyan warplanes also overflew the skies of the city as militia anti-aircraft gunners opened fire on them. Clashes reportedly began when Ansar al-Sharia militiamen attacked the Libyan Special Forces battalion base with rockets and mortars, inflicting casualties. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
New Malawian President Peter Mutharika was inaugurated today after an election that was disputed by his predecessor. Mr. Mutharika told supporters at Blantyre Stadium that he wanted to reconcile with former President Joyce Banda, whose demand for a new election was rejected by Malawi's High Court. The new president said, I come to her with an olive branch in my hand, but added, do not let it drop. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia will submit a draft United Nations Security Council resolution today, calling for the creation of a humanitarian corridor in eastern Ukraine. Lavrov told reporters the resolution also calls for an end to the ongoing violence in that region and described the situation as one that's getting worse. He says, our Western colleagues have been telling us for quite a long time that as soon as the presidential election is held in Ukraine, the situation will calm down. But everything is happening in exactly the opposite way. U.S. President Barack Obama embarks on a four-day trip to Europe this week. He leaves Washington tonight for stops in Poland, Belgium, and France. The U.S. leader's trip to Europe comes at a time when Russia has made threatening moves on Ukraine. There is also deep uncertainty about Ukraine President-elect Petro Poroshenko's ability to stabilize his country. Mr. Obama will meet with Mr. Poroshenko in Poland. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has sworn in a new unity government between Fatah and Hamas, the two groups that have separately governed the West Bank and Gaza Strip for the past 7 years. The ceremony in Ramallah went ahead today after the two sides overcame a last-minute dispute over a decision by Mr. Abbas to not include a Ministry of Prison Affairs. Afghanistan's government reacted in anger at President Barack Obama's decision to release five Taliban detainees from U.S. detention at Guantanamo Bay in Qatar's jurisdiction in exchange for an American soldier who had been held by the Taliban for 5 years. Sharon Bain reports.
Afghanistan's foreign ministry said the U.S. decision to free five Taliban commanders, then to turn over the detainees to Qatar, was a potential breach of international law. Reuters quoted a source close to Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who said Mr. Karzai is even more distrustful of U.S. intentions in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ahmed Shakab Mostaghni said Monday the government had handed over an official note to the U.S. Embassy in Kabul questioning the conditions of the prisoners' release. The prisoner swap secured the release of the only U.S. prisoner of war in Afghanistan, Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Sharon Bain, Islamabad.
Spain's King Juan Carlos is stepping down from the throne, clearing the way for his son, Prince Felipe, to take over. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy made the abdication announcement today on national television. It was not immediately clear when the abdication will take place. The Obama administration has unveiled a plan to cut carbon emission from power plants in the United States by nearly one-third in the next 15 years. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy called the proposal she outlined today as ambitious but achievable. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's 18 hours UTC and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Yiswuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
State radio in Cameroon reports that Cameroon's military has killed at least 60 Boko Haram members who crossed over from Nigeria seeking refuge.
That's Bonki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details next. Also in the news, the new president of Malawi, Peter Mutharika, today pledged in his inaugural address to bring economic growth to the country. And the World Health Organization reports that cholera is spreading rapidly in South Sudan's capital, Juba. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Djibouti, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour. State radio in Cameroon reports that Cameroon's military has killed at least 60 Boko Haram members who crossed over from Nigeria seeking refuge. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
The 60 heavily armed Boko Haram members reportedly killed in the village of Dabanga in far northern Cameroon crossed over from Borno State in Nigeria, according to Cameroon's national radio, which said they were ambushed by Cameroonian soldiers. The governor of the far north region of Cameroon, Fonka Awa, says his office had received information that some Boko Haram members might be hiding in Cameroonian villages and asked for specialized troops to be deployed. He told VOA that the military had done a good job.
Of course, yes, without missing words. After such a situation, you reassemble the forces and map out strategies. You galvanize them and put them back into action. And I think that's what we've just done.
Ebenezer Akanga, a journalist who works with Cameroon's national broadcaster, told VOA in a telephone interview that if military had carried out similar attacks in the past, Boko Haram would not be using Cameroon as a safe haven.
The opinion many people hold is that from the beginning, the government seemed to have been caressing the Boko Harams. The government didn't seem to have taken this fight very seriously. This is what was expected to be done from the very word go. In fact, if the military had this type of reaction, it would have deterred the Boko Harams from crossing to Cameroonian territory. Heavy military arsenal and also troops have been deployed in the far north region, stating that the government is determined to take this fight to the Boko Haram camp and to discourage the Boko Harams from coming to the far north region.
Akanga says security forces from Cameroon and Nigeria should work together to eliminate Boko Haram from the two countries.
The military has to adopt different strategies because now it doesn't simply suffice chasing away the Boko Harams. The fight needs to be taken to their very backyard. Even if officially there may not be agreements authorizing the Cameroon military to cross to the Nigerian territory, I personally think that this fight cannot be won by fighting the Boko Harams only in the Cameroon territory. The fight should be taken to their own camp out there in Nigeria.
Last month, Nigeria's neighbors Cameroon and Chad both declared war on Boko Haram. Cameroon has since deployed 2,000 troops along its borders with Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
The new president of Malawi, Peter Mutharika, today pledged in his inaugural address to bring economic growth to the country. His goal is a 7% growth rate. He says he'll rely on help from his new vice president, local economist, and telecom executive, Saulos Chilima. Mutharika, who's 74, was sworn into office on Saturday, moments after the National Election Commission declared he took the most votes in the controversy-filled May 20th election. He was declared the winner with more than 36% of the vote. Mutharika is a law professor, former foreign minister, and brother of the late president, Binguwa Mutharika. He defeated incumbent Joyce Banda and another candidate, Lazarus Chakawira. Banda received only about 20% of the vote. She charged that the election was rigged and demanded a manual recount. Her request was rejected by the Election Commission. Somalia is again facing growing food insecurity. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames it on late rains, a poor harvest, and ongoing conflict. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
It's estimated 800,000 Somalis currently are in need of food aid. Of those, 200,000 are described as malnourished children under age 5. Senior economist Shukri Ahmed says $18 million is needed over the next 90 days to scale up rapid interventions.
These 3 months are very important, actually, because this is what we call the hunger season. It is usually just before the main harvest. The main harvest starts in August. And this is when you would have depleted your stocks from the earlier crop, which this year was also not very good. It was relatively poor.
Ahmed says Somalia has some fundamental and chronic problems affecting its food supply.
Whenever there is some escalation of one or the other, we raise these alarms. It could be the security situation that goes from bad to worse in certain cases, and in others it is the rainfall situation and drought conditions again rearing their head, and in others it is a combination of these things coming together.
He says such combinations proved to be deadly in the past in Somalia. It's not clear whether the late and erratic rainfall is due to climate change. Ahmed says that would require further study. The current conditions, though, are well known in the region.
Generally, the Eastern Africa, particularly Horn of Africa, what we know as Somalia, parts of Ethiopia, parts of Kenya, and even parts of Tanzania, have this erratic rainfall, and every now and then there is this drought happening. But now that we don't have infrastructure on the ground, the small irrigation systems that we have broken in Somalia and all this are coming together actually to create havoc on food security.
The late and erratic Gu rains, which normally occur from April through June, follow January's poor harvest in southern Somalia. Maize and sorghum prices have risen between 60% and 80%.
There was this escalation of conflict in main producing areas. So it didn't give farmers enough time, actually, to prepare their land and to harvest.
AU, Kenyan, and Somali forces continue to battle the militant group Al-Shabaab. The FAO senior economist says Somalis have done their best to cope.
Somalis are resilient people. Generally, through trade and through exchange and through markets, they were able actually to absorb most of these shocks.
He says the estimated $1 billion in remittances from Somalis abroad were also crucial. The rapid intervention programs for Somalia include distribution of seeds and vouchers for fertilizers and the use of tractors, pest and disease prevention and control, and a temporary cash for work project to rebuild some infrastructure.
The canals, the irrigation, and working on those and rehabilitating them so that whatever rain comes, farmers and others would be able to use them. So the creation of employment is for the productive part, the productive assets of the people, which then helps the livelihoods of the population.
Another part of the rapid intervention includes the restocking of livestock for about 4,000 pastoralists. The FAO expects conditions to improve slightly in Somalia in August and September, when the next harvest should be ready. It says the Gu rains resumed in early May, but would have to continue through the end of June to prevent food security conditions from getting worse. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization reports that cholera is spreading rapidly in South Sudan's capital city, Juba. The WHO says aid agencies and the Ministry of Health are intensifying efforts to stop the spread of the disease in the city and to prevent outbreaks in other parts of the country. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization is worried at how quickly cholera has spread in South Sudan's capital since the disease was first confirmed on April 23rd. It reports more than 1,000 cases, including 27 deaths in Juba, with unconfirmed cases reported in other parts of this war-torn country, including in Jonglei, Lakes, and Upper Nile states. A WHO specialist in cholera, Dr. Dominique Legros, says the unsanitary conditions of the displaced persons camps and the onset of the rainy season are expected to accelerate the spread of this often fatal disease.
I think that we have to be ready for a situation of a large epidemic, if you want to call it an epidemic, in the country. It's very difficult to predict how outbreaks of cholera evolve. We know that they go very fast, and we have seen this again this time in Juba. For the moment, outside Juba, we don't see so far big outbreaks.
Legault says controlling the outbreak in more remote areas will be complicated during the rainy season as roads become impassable, cutting off access. He says this period usually provokes an upsurge in cholera cases due to flooding that contaminates water sources. Cholera spreads through contaminated food and water. It causes severe vomiting and acute diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration. It can kill within hours if left untreated, but most cases are successfully treated with oral rehydration salts. Legault says two main strategies are in place for containing the disease. In Juba, he says, aid workers are trying to improve sanitation and provide safe water. He says they also are setting up treatment centers so people can easily access health care.
Then outside Juba, we have a system in place that was already in place before that we have reinforced, with notably rapid tests for cholera, to detect as early as possible upsurge of cholera cases, beginning of outbreaks, so that we can try to contain them. And of course, in similar settings, preposition material for treatment and staff when needed.
Legros says security concerns because of the ongoing war hamper efforts to control the disease. For example, an evening curfew in Juba limits movement, making it difficult for both cholera patients and healthcare workers to go to treatment centers. He says a few weeks ago, WHO and partners vaccinated displaced people at a camp in the northern part of South Sudan. But because of heightened security, health workers are not able to return to the camp to carry out a second round. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Ihie Suhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. State radio in Cameroon reports that Cameroon's military has killed at least 60 Boko Haram members who crossed over from Nigeria seeking refuge. The new president of Malawi, Peter Mutharika, today pledged in his inaugural address to bring economic growth to the country. And Somalia is again facing growing food insecurity. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Libyan military forces loyal to former Army Chief of Staff General Khalifa Haftar are battling militiamen from the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Ansar al-Sariya group in Benghazi, with planes and helicopters bombing Ansar al-Sariya positions. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo that Libyan TV says 20 people are dead and more than 80 wounded.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Libyan army helicopters strafed positions of the al-Qaeda-linked Ansar al-Sharia militia in the eastern port city of Benghazi Monday amid sporadic fighting. Libyan warplanes also overflew the skies of the city as militia anti-aircraft gunners opened fire on them. Clashes reportedly began when Ansar al-Sharia militiamen attacked the Libyan Special Forces Battalion base with rockets and mortars, inflicting casualties. Amateur video showed rocket fire lighting the pre-dawn skies of the city. The Libyan military joint operations spokesman Ibrahim Shara says the militia attacked the army's Al-Sa'ika Battalion 21 base. He says that Ansar al-Sharia militia vehicles on patrol opened fire on the special forces base, to which army forces responded with their own fire. He says that after 3 hours of fighting, Libyan army warplanes entered the fray to relieve forces on the ground. The Libyan Air Force, which has sworn loyalty to former Army Chief of Staff Khalifa Haftar, has bombed Islamist militia bases in Benghazi a number of times during the past week. Libyan TV showed live images of empty streets and parts of Benghazi during the day, with the muffled sound of shells falling in the background. The TV said stores were closed and end-of-year student exams had been postponed. The report said casualties were being taken to several hospitals. Sky News Arabia reported that dead bodies were seen lying in the street in several parts of the city. Libyan TV played music to honor those who have died in recent fighting. The TV said many Benghazi residents have expressed support for the army operation against Islamist militiamen being led by General Haftar. Haftar has locked horns with Libya's interim parliament and its two rival prime ministers, each of whom claim to represent the government. Haftar has called the National Assembly illegal since its mandate ran out in February. He indicated last week that he would not support a June 25th election for a new assembly because of the deteriorating security situation. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Egyptian security officials say a mob burned the shops of Coptic Christians in the village of Al-Mahamid near Luxor today. Officials said the mob was made up of Islamists who threw gasoline bombs on the shops. No injuries or deaths were reported. The attacks occurred several hours before the start of the blasphemy trial in Al-Mahamid of a young Coptic Christian. The youth was charged with contempt of Islam over a series of alleged internet postings. Coptic Christians are estimated to be 10% of the population of Egypt. During his campaign, Egypt's president-elect Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised to heal the nation's ailing economy. And while many Egyptians have high hopes for newfound safety and prosperity, Mr. Sisi has called on Egyptians to make sacrifices, and he warned it will take years to reform the economy. But after 3 years of upheaval and no clear economic program, how much sacrifice can they take? Heather Murdoch has more from Cairo.
Once popular with tourists, this market has mostly local shoppers a few days after the presidential election. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been declared the winner. Pre-election pro-Sisi music still blares on the streets. Locals say the tourism industry, like others in Egypt, has flatlined.
يعني بتشتغل ولا
بتشتغل
يعني مين الوجه
احمد علا makes traditional boxes and games out of wood and mother of pearl. He says business has been bad since the 2011 revolution.
So actually before the revolution we was working very much and it was a lot it was many tourists in Egypt. But after the revolution, we feel very, very bad because the economy in Egypt, it's not only the tourists. Everything is damaged and everything's fall down.
Mr. Sisi's ideas to improve the economy were already in play before the votes were counted. The government plans to cut subsidies and reduce the national deficit. Mohammed Gad is a senior economic reporter at El Sharouk, a prominent Egyptian newspaper. He says the plan could backfire and a large cut in fuel subsidies could cause more unrest.
To some degree, this is an unprecedented move by the Egyptian state to deal with the subsidy. Without having a clear vision and alternative policies that would ease the economic pressure on both people in dire poverty and the middle class, it could bring down the social system.
Despite widespread poverty, the incoming president has called for sacrifices from the Egyptian people, suggesting they eat less food, walk more, and use less electricity to help their economy recover. He says he will significantly improve the economy and the security situation within 2 years.
المصريين بيتطلعوا لحاجات كثيرة جدا.
The Egyptian people expected a lot of things. During two revolutions, they were aspiring for bread, freedom, social justice. The Egyptians wanted to live like this. I need to give them security, stability, and complete development.
But activists say the Egyptian public will not wait 2 years for change. Human rights worker Abdul Rahman Hani says the public will lose patience.
People will take on the streets for two reasons. First reason regarding Sisi, because he would not fulfill everything he promised regarding economic recovery or take the first steps toward economic recovery. I don't think this will happen under his rule.
Mr. Sisi will be Egypt's third president in 3.5 years after the last two were ousted by popular protests. Mr. Sisi, the former army chief and defense minister, has been running the country since the army imprisoned former President Mohamed Morsi last July. Thousands of people have been killed or arrested since then, accused of being associated with Morsi's party, the Muslim Brotherhood. Despite the turmoil and an income of less than $150 a month, the wood craftsman, Ahmed, says, for now, he can live with some sacrifices.
So actually, we need to work more and we need to give Egypt more because we can exchange the life different than now, you know?
Ahmed also worries that the people will not have the patience to wait for reforms. But in the meantime, he hopes, at least with a real president in charge again, some tourists will return to his market. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Cairo.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Yisroel in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. State radio in Cameroon reports the country's military has killed at least 60 Boko Haram members who crossed over from Nigeria seeking refuge. The new president of Malawi, Peter Mutharika, today pledged in his inaugural address to bring economic growth to the country. And Somalia is again facing growing food insecurity. Coming up, music from Djibouti, and in our feature series, the first of a five-part report on the war against the ivory trade. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sonny, I understand the World Cup countdown continues.
Yehias, we're now only 10 days away until the kickoff of the Football World Cup in Brazil. And the 32 participating teams are continuing their preparations. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, Brazil will host Croatia in the opening match June 12th in Sao Paulo. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon warmed up for their African record 7th World Cup appearance with a 2-2 friendly draw Sunday against host Germany. Four-time African Footballer of the Year Samuel Eto'o, who will be playing in his 4th World Cup, opened the scoring in the 62nd minute. The Chelsea man converted a pass from teammate Eric-Maxim Choupo-Moting. The Germans equalized off a header from Thomas Müller and then took the lead on a goal by André Schürrle, one of Eto'o's teammates at Chelsea. Choupo-Moting then got the equalizer for Cameroon with about 12 minutes left in the match. Cameroon will kick off its World Cup campaign June 13th when it plays Mexico in Natal, Brazil. Then the indomitable Lions will play Croatia June 18th in Manaus, Brazil, before wrapping up group play against host Brazil June 23rd in Brasilia. Just ahead, our Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, will have more World Cup tidbits for us. Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky. And when we stand to stand, show the world where you're from, show where you're from. Show the world we are one.
That's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, entitled We Are One. It's now clear that Brazil didn't do a very good job preparing for the tournament. There are still concerns about the country's readiness. Doubts remain about whether some stadiums will be fully ready. And it's already known that not all promised infrastructure work will be completed. Organizers will also have to worry about the widespread street protests that are expected during the tournament, with demonstrators already unhappy about corruption, poor public services, and the billions of dollars being spent to host the World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. Even though Brazil was awarded the World Cup in 2007, the local organizers are scrambling to complete all the necessary work. World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, acknowledged recently that it was, quote, a race, unquote, to make sure the country delivers everything it promised. We are very close now, FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volpe said. Soon we are going to hand the tournament over to the players and the 32 teams. There is very little to worry about. We just need to make sure the teams arrive safely and get to their training centers so they can begin preparing for the tournament. Construction work at stadiums is still underway, however, including the one hosting the opening match between Brazil and Croatia on June 12th in Sao Paulo. All six venues that were expected to be ready by the end of last year missed FIFA's deadline. The other six had already been used during the Confederations Cup last year, but four of those also were not ready when expected. Because the venues took so long to be ready, FIFA is now struggling to install the temporary structures that are crucial for the media, the sponsors, and technical teams. Back here in Africa, three of the five teams that are built to fly the African flag in Brazil were in action on Saturday. Algeria, Ghana, and Ivory Coast were engaged in friendlies, with Algeria the only one of the three teams to emerge victorious. The Desert Foxes of Algeria defeated Armenia 3-1 in their friendly in Switzerland. Defender Bekalem opened the score in the 14th minute before Gila scored the second goal in the 22nd and Slimani the third on the 41st minute. Armenia Atosakisov scored his team's only goal in the 46th minute. Algeria will play its second friendly on Wednesday against Romania at the Geneva Stadium also in Switzerland before heading for Brazil on Saturday, June 7th. In Brazil, Algeria will play at the group stage against Belgium, Russia, and South Korea. In Rotterdam, hosts the Netherlands continued its build-up to the finals with a 1-0 win over fellow Brazil-bound Ghana. Manchester United striker Robin van Persie's 5th-minute goal proved decisive in the match. 2010 quarterfinalist Ghana was unable to produce any real chances. And in the United States, Bosnia defeated Ivory Coast 2-1 in their warm-up in a match that Nigeria must have watched closely. Edin Dzeko scored twice for Bosnia, while Didier Drogba scored with a free kick on his 100th international.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
The Ivorians play El Salvador on Wednesday also in the United States, where they have been preparing over the last week for the tournament in Brazil. Ivory Coast will play Japan, Colombia, and Greece in Group C. Bosnia is in Nigeria's group at the World Cup. Meanwhile, Ghana coach Kwesi Appiah has praised the unity and discipline in his squad. The unity is so great and discipline is very high. Discipline plays a big role. If you want to be successful, 100% lies with the players' behavior. And so far, it has been good, the coach says. Let's now quickly run down the list of five players to watch in each of Africa's five World Cup-bound teams, as compiled by the Associated Press news agency. Algeria, Soufiane Feghouli, Algeria's most skillful player who is based in Spain. Fawzi Ghoulam, the French-born player based in Italy. Majid Bouguerra, Algeria captain who has been a mainstay in central defense over the past 10 years. Rafik Djebbo, who has yet to carry his club form over to the international scene, having scored 39 goals in 56 games for Greek side Olympiacos. And El Abi Hilal Sudani, the Dynamo Zagreb player who can play all across the attack. Ivory Coast.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
Didier Drogba, now 36, who remains the team's talismanic player with more than 60 international goals to his name. Yaya Toure, slightly less revered than Didier Drogba among Ivorian fans, but only just. Gervinho, who has got his career back on track and proved many critics wrong when he joined Italian club Roma last year after frustration in England. Didier Zokora, who has been around for so long that he even has more international appearances than Yaya Toure and Didier Drogba. And Serge Aurier, the defender who brings much-needed youth to an aging team. Five players to watch in Cameroon. Samuel Eto'o, four-time African Player of the Year, who is at the twilight of his career, but still capable of blistering performances. Alexander Song, who is not playing on a regular basis at Barcelona, but remains a stalwart of the Cameroon team. Vincent Aboubakar, the center forward who has been tipped by some pundits as the future star of African football. Charles Itanje, a top-class goalkeeper in the class of Thomas Nkono, Joseph Antoine Bell, and Carlos Idris Kameni. And Eric Maxim Choupo-Moting, who can be a good cover for Samuel Eto'o if the Chelsea striker is unavailable through injury or suspension. Nigeria, Emmanuel Emenike, the 27-year-old Fenerbahce forward, who continued his good form with crucial goals in Nigeria's World Cup qualifying campaign. Victor Moses, though struggling for game time at Liverpool, plays a valuable role for Nigeria. John Obi Mikel, who gives Nigeria stability in central midfield that allows forwards Emmanuel Emenike and Victor Moses and midfielders like Ahmed Musa and Sunday Mba to create and score goals. Sunday Mba, the attacking midfielder, with a hard shot. And Ife Ambrose, a right back or central defender who gives Nigeria an extra attacking outlet on the right flank, as well as defensive solidity in times of trouble. Finally, the five players to watch in the Ghana squad.
Hi, I'm Michael Essien, midfielder, Ghana.
Michael Essien, the 31-year-old who returned to the squad last year, his ability to power Ghana's World Cup challenge from the middle of the field may be crucial to the Black Stars' hopes of reaching the latter stages. Kevin Prince-Boateng, who scored in the last playoff match against Egypt and offers big game experience from Euro's top leagues. Asamoah Gyan, Ghana's leader from the front, who has taken on the captaincy and often fights a lone battle as Ghana's solitary striker. Kwadwo Asamoah, a versatile and valuable 25-year-old Juventus player with 6 years of experience with Ghana and 6 years in Serie A. And Andrew Ayew, the 24-year-old winger who has pace and skill and can also play as a second striker. Thanks a lot for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled World Cup's Group of Death, and I write about Group G, which features Germany, Portugal, Ghana, and the USA. Germany and Portugal, currently ranked number 2 and number 3 in the FIFA World Rankings, are the favorites on paper. But as I write in the blog, there are upsets and surprises at the World Cup, and I won't be surprised to see a few at Brazil 2014. Finally, the National Basketball Association finals tip off Thursday night in San Antonio, Texas. The San Antonio Spurs will host the two-time defending champion Miami Heat in a rematch of the 2013 NBA Finals. Our VOA basketball fans will remember the Heat won the trophy last year in a hard-fought seven-game series against the Spurs. The last time two teams faced each other in back-to-back years in the NBA Finals was in 1997 and 1998, when the Michael Jordan-led Chicago Bulls beat the Utah Jazz both times. Spurs Heat rematch in the NBA Finals. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Wu.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. In our feature series, the first of a five-part report on the war against the ivory trade. And next, scientists at the U.S. Naval Laboratory turning water into fuel. But first, some music. Here is King Khalid of Djibouti with Kini.
Gauguna hurda, sidagar santari, ga
கவரியாய் தர்றதா துரைனையா சோமா ஆஹா சோமா ஆஹா சோமா வந்தவன் ஆஹா 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 தக்கோ கமாசரோ கெலவு குண உருத சிதகர் சந்தரி கவரியாய் தர்றதா
Djibouti's King Khalid with Kini. The illegal killing of an elephant in a national park in Kenya is now a national security issue in Washington, D.C. and in many more countries of the world. A new, tougher approach to poaching comes as the trafficking of elephant tusks and rhino horns reaches nearly $20 billion in annual sales. VOA's William Eagle brings you the first of five reports on the war against the ivory trade.
U.S. policymakers have discovered that terrorists who destabilize African countries pay for their rebellions with the profits from selling the tusks of dead elephants. Under the Eiffel Tower in Paris, the French government destroyed 3 tons of ivory before TV cameras. The United States pulled 6 tons from a warehouse and publicly crushed them for photographers at a national wildlife refuge in Colorado. And China crushed 6 tons of ivory tusks in Guangdong province and incinerated another 28 tons in Hong Kong. The killing of Africa's elephants is a long-standing concern of wildlife conservationists. They are now joined by leaders in global law enforcement, economic development, and better governance, argues John Calvelli, an executive vice president of the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York.
This is just, we're reaching an epidemic proportion that's having long-term implications for the survival of the species, but also creating real areas of uncertainty and destabilization. So at the end of the day, the report that came out, all these reports are all pointing to that same direction, that there's a call for action coming from the African nations themselves. We need to be dealing with this issue.
Brooke Darby, the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, says poaching is no longer viewed as just a wildlife conservation issue. Washington's decision to get tough on poachers and traffickers is triggered by the rapid growth of an illegal industry some estimate is now a $19 billion business.
The U.S. government and many other governments around the world have been looking at wildlife trafficking as a conservation issue for a long period of time. But I think in the last few years, driven by the high demand and the high prices for wildlife products, as well as the low risk of detection and very minimal penalties, we've really seen an uptick in organized criminal groups and, to some extent, terrorist networks being drawn into the trade.
Major criminal syndicates have added ivory to their portfolio of illegal trafficking in gold, guns, and drugs. Poaching is fast becoming a serious crime. In the natural resources of Africa, that's an estimated 30,000 elephants slaughtered illegally in 2012, double the number killed 5 years before, and triple the estimates of 14 years ago. In April, representatives of 46 countries gathered at the London Zoological Garden and signed a declaration to stop the illegal trade. 2 months ago, President Obama issued a national strategy declaring that wildlife trafficking now threatens not only national and global wildlife resources, but also national and global security. Darby said what she calls some terrorist entities are involved. Many conservation organizations agree. Conservationist and development agencies have been struggling with poaching for years, writes Johan Bergenus in a recent Stimson Center report, killing animals, buying arms.
And as the issue of poaching and wildlife crime become part of the family, if you will, of transnational crime challenges in the region, I think we can all benefit from looking at it from a security and defense perspective. And for the conservation and development community and the defense and security community to find overlapping opportunities to initiate programs on the ground and at the policy level to leverage each other's resources.
The U.S. contribution to anti-poaching is part of an overall $80 million global commitment strategy marshaled by the Global Clinton Initiative, or GCI. It follows a three-pronged strategy: support Africa's park rangers, stop the trafficking, and tell consumers to stop buying ivory statues and jewelry. They have gathered $80 million in commitments from governments, foundations, and others such as philanthropist Howard Buffett. Calvelli gives Hillary Clinton credit for asking the Director of National Intelligence to determine if there was a crucial link between poaching and terrorism.
It's pretty historic in one respect that so many groups have come together in such a short amount of time to deal with this issue. In Secretary Clinton's conversations with African leaders, you started to see that the call is really coming from the African leaders themselves. They were seeing the destruction of their natural heritage.
But some observers are concerned that the new collaborative strategies will take too much time to implement. They fear that elephants and rhinos in the wild may not be able to wait that long. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Tomorrow, we'll hear what happened to the elephants and hippos in the middle of Central Africa's civil wars. For centuries, alchemists have tried to turn lead into gold. That transmutation has long been proven impossible. But another similar dream, turning water into fuel, seems to be achievable. Scientists at the U.S. Naval Laboratory proved it by flying a model airplane burning re-engineered seawater. VOA's Jor Putik has the story.
Natural gas and liquid fuels burned in all kinds of internal combustion engines are chemical compounds of hydrogen and carbon, coming mostly from underground reserves. But oceans are also huge reservoirs of hydrogen and increasingly carbon dioxide, or CO2. Dissolved in seawater from the air, it makes the water more acidic. Extracting those chemicals from the ocean and converting them into a form of liquid fuel was made possible by some recent technological advances, says U.S. Navy researcher Dr. Heather Willauer.
We've been actually able to show that we can recombine CO2 and hydrogen in the laboratory on a laboratory scale, into a liquid-type fuel.
The process requires a lot of electrical energy, which, to be economical, has to come from a cheap source, such as a nuclear power plant. Obviously, the most efficient place to do it would be aboard a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Willauer says these ships may someday manufacture their own jet fuel.
Well, it is a game changer potentially for the Navy or commercial entities, because you can make fuel potentially where and when you need it.
The new fuel was successfully tested on a model airplane with a two-stroke engine. For now, making it requires twice as much power than the fuel can produce, but researchers hope to lower that ratio. Willauer says the new process will not increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which contributes to global warming.
Once we've pulled it out of seawater, the ocean is ready to pull it back in from the atmosphere because it's in constant equilibrium. So what we hope is it's a carbon neutral footprint.
Scientists hope a small-scale industrial plant may start converting seawater into fuel within the next 15 years. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many developing nations, the extraction of minerals is crucial to the local economy. If used for the common good, these resources can lift countries out of poverty by providing jobs and accelerating economic growth to provide quality education, health care, and other needed government services. Or they can be a source of untold misery. In areas where governance is weak or absent, armed groups may fill the vacuum and commandeer valuable resources for themselves. In such places, these groups may force villagers to mine minerals and then use the profits from their sale to fund insurgencies against legitimate governments or terrorize local communities. The United States has played a leading role in a number of international efforts to address the conflict minerals trade. Under one initiative, known as Dodd-Frank Section 1502, for the part of the law that created it, U.S. companies are required to account for the use of gold, tin, tungsten, and tantalum, and their ores in their products, and then investigate their supply chain to determine if these minerals were used to fuel the conflict in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. This action was taken to break the link between armed groups and minerals and to create legitimate channels for these resources. Since this and other initiatives were begun, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo have made progress in developing legitimate supply chains for their conflict minerals. Some armed groups continue to exploit the region's resources, however, posing a threat to regional stability and undermining international efforts to end the decades-long strife there. Toward that end, U.S. financial regulators have issued an order affirming that companies must report on whether their products contain conflict minerals from the DRC or neighboring nations. The deadline for compliance is June 2nd of this year. Developing a legitimate mining industry is critical for building an economic base for sustainable peace in the eastern DRC and Great Lakes region. Due diligence by U.S. companies plays an important role in combating the illicit exploitation of these minerals by promoting a responsible minerals trade worldwide.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.